Hello, this is Matt, and you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. Earlier this year in January, two patients tragically passed away at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow. When tested, both patients showed signs of a fungal infection caused by a fungus called Cryptococcus neoformans, or more commonly, just Cryptococcus. Whilst one of the patient's death was unrelated to the infection, it has been confirmed that it was a contributing factor to the death of the second patient.
My name's Liz. I'm a researcher at the University of Birmingham, where I'm currently a Henry Dale Fellow.
Dr. Liz Ballou studies how human fungal pathogens survive and cause disease in their host, and has worked extensively with Cryptococcus. Liz was kind enough to come onto the podcast to talk about Cryptococcus and gave us a fantastic overview of Cryptococcus research, the life cycle of the fungus, and the disease it can cause. We started off by discussing why she finds Cryptococcus so interesting and how she got into this area of research.
The thing that I'm really interested in terms of understanding fungi in general is how do they sense their environment and then how do they respond to it? So Cryptococcus is a great system for studying that because it has these really dramatic changes that it does in response to environmental signals. Whenever you hear about Cryptococcus, people always mention seeing it for the first time. And this is one of the stories that sort of got me into Cryptococcus research in the first place, because there is this guy named John Perfect. He always tells the story, so I feel like I can probably tell it for him pretty accurately. On Valentine's Day in 1978, he was seeing a patient who came into the clinic with meningitis. When he looked at the cells that were in cerebrospinal fluid that he collected in this patient, it was this transformative moment in his career where he could see these beautiful capsular structures that is this very complex polysaccharide that outlines these cells, and it's really a distinctive look. And he took that observation and he made a career out of it. For the next 40 years, he's been studying that organism, and he's really inspired a lot of people to understand how this organism grows. My research specifically focuses on understanding, again, another dramatic transition that Cryptococcus undergoes in the host. The other thing that we see when we look at patient samples is typically when you look at Cryptococcus neoformans, it's a budding yeast, so it looks very similar to Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the yeast that makes beer and wine, but it is fundamentally different. It is a basidiomycete, not an ascomycete, so it's much more closely related to mushrooms than it is to Candida albicans, aspergillosis, and the sort of model organisms that people study. And that gives it a lot of fundamental properties. When we look at it in the lab, it looks like this small yeast, about 5 micron, which is, you know, bigger than a bacterium, but smaller than a macrophage. But when you look at patient samples, what you see are these huge cells. They can be 100 micron, much too large for the human host to deal with. And these samples, people have seen them since the 70s and 80s, but they were only really described as a phenomenon in 2010, and they called them Titan cells. And that was right when I was coming out of graduate school, when I really captured my imagination, and I wanted to be able to understand how does a host signal cause this transformation from these small haploid yeast to these highly polyploid, very, very large Titan cells. And so that's the question that my lab has been chasing. And the major breakthrough that we had last year was the development of an actual in vitro model for being able to grow these cells. Because since they were discovered in 2010, no one's really been able to study them in the lab. We've always had to rely on animal models where you put the fungus into a mouse, you wait a few days, you recover the yeast, and then you look to see what happens.
I'm just interested, why was it so difficult to make the cells go into these Titan cells without the host there? Just the conditions, or?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. Why is it so hard? And it ends up being a sort of philosophical answer, because most of the people who study Cryptococcus, people have two different backgrounds. They're either clinicians who have gotten into the field because they really want to help patients that are coming into the clinics, or they are people who have come into it from a much more basic perspective in terms of they were trained as Saccharomyces biologists and they have now moved into a new model system. And that really means that the techniques that people use to study these organisms are based on what they already know how to do, right? And in both of those systems, people have different ways of growing the fungus that are just sort of the way that you propagate. And most of those are based on growth in rich media. And one of the things that we always tell students before you start your experiment is start with a fresh culture, you know, make it a happy growing yeast, then do your experiment, right? It's a very sort of classic lesson that people learn when they first start working in doing microbiology. But it turns out that's not the way that fungi experience their environments, right? They actually are really good at living in desiccation, in hypoxia, in nutrient poor conditions. And it was only until we started growing ourselves under those sort of more challenging conditions that the fungus actually started doing this thing that we're really interested in.
Right. So it's just that they're not used to growing in these perfect environments.
Yeah, right. It's this sort of fundamental change in how you think about your system. It's not like there's one answer to this problem. It's actually about putting the cells under more physiologically relevant conditions, and then they do this phenotype. The paper that we published, we stumbled on this, and I'll tell you the story. In my lab, what happened was I'm a geneticist, and I was really interested in understanding the molecular mechanisms that caused this transition from the small cells to the large cells. And I had a hint that maybe some genes that were involved in a particular kind of signaling called redox transduction, I was looking at growing my cells in ways that would make it easier to study that process, which is a very challenging thing to study, and no one had really tackled it in Cryptococcus yet. So I had an undergraduate in the lab, Tom Drake, and I wanted to show him some basic phenotypes of Cryptococcus, and Capsula we just talked about was one of those. And the classic way to induce Capsule is to grow the cells in rich medium like you do, and then them into serum. And serum is meant to be a host kind of relevant trigger. He said, Tom, I've got to go to a meeting, but I'd like you to look at Capsule as part of your thesis. And so just grow the cells and then put them under serum. So he grew his cells in mineral media, and then he put them in serum. And then he went on the microscope and took some pictures. And he sent me an email at this meeting that I was at that basically said, I think something's really wrong because they don't look normal. In fact, they look really big. And I said, oh my gosh, you figured it out. You've got Titan cells. See the picture he sent me, it's just so obvious that that was what we had found. And so we went back and showed that by growing our cells in minimal media and then putting them in serum, we're able to induce this change. And that we think is really mimicking what's happening in patients where they might be exposed to a fungus on pigeon guano or other dried environment. They breathe the spores in, they come from this nutrient star condition into the lung where they're exposed to this host relevant signal. And then they undergo this morphological transition. So it's really about, I think, modeling what's happening in the environment and in patients that can give us this particular insight.
So how prevalent is Cryptococcus in the environment?
Yeah, so if we think a little bit about the ecology of these organisms, if we look at whether or not people in a particular population have been exposed to Cryptococcus, by the age of 21, 70% of us have seropositivity, meaning we have antibodies against Cryptococcus. By the age of 5, 50% of people. So most people at this point will have seen this organism as somewhere in the environment, and it really doesn't cause a problem. Typically, the places that it's growing are associated with soil. Pigeon guano is a major, we think, vector. And trees, you know, anywhere where birds hang out, not because birds are carriers, but because the nutrient conditions in bird guano are particularly well suited to this organism.
What's the life cycle like, and how does it cause the infection?
In those environments, we think it's living as either a spore or as a desiccated yeast. People have done work showing that in plant debris, so in decaying material, you have Cryptococcus growing as a hyphae, and then it can produce these beautiful basidium and spores that are the products of mating and meiosis. And then also we think that the dried yeast form, the desiccated yeast, is another major propagule that people would be infected with. So the life cycle is that it's growing in the environment, happily not bothering people. Someone comes along, breathes in the spores. It's either controlled in the lung, or it can grow in the lung and cause pneumonia, and it can grow both intracellularly and extracellularly. So macrophages are very good at engulfing these things, but not so good at killing them. And then it can actually escape the lung, we think, through a macrophage-mediated process. So basically, macrophages, we think, carry Cryptococcus and then kind of carry it across the blood-brain barrier in this classic Trojan horse mechanism. So when patients come into the clinic, what they actually are presenting with is typically meningitis. The vast majority of people who get cryptococcal meningitis already have some underlying problem. Most people who are healthy are not at risk for this disease.
Yeah, so like many diseases, you're okay unless you're immunosuppressed somehow.
Exactly. And you know, with HIV/AIDS, it's people who have CD4 counts below 100. So really, they're quite ill already.
When they come in, what kind of symptoms are they showing?
Yeah, so typically when people come in with this disease, They come in with headaches, loss of vision, confusion, all the symptoms of meningitis. But there is also a pneumonia that precedes meningitis. It's typically an asymptomatic pneumonia. People might not even realize they're sick. And then when they get this meningitis, then it's a major indicator of immunosuppression. So when the HIV/AIDS epidemic was sort of coming to the forefront, one of the most important diseases that doctors started seeing and that told them that something really unusual was happening was cryptococcus. When we think about it now, we can start surveying populations for pneumonia, treating the pneumonia, and preventing these really horrible symptoms that come with the meningitis.
Right. So like many awful diseases, it's you could be showing all the signs or none of the signs.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think it's very challenging to diagnose because, you know, the symptoms are diffuse. Like I've got a headache and maybe a cough.
So globally, how many people a year contract cryptococcus?
We estimate that 1 million people every year are infected and become ill with cryptococcus. And that's fatal if it's left untreated. We're able to get the mortality rates down through treatment. And we have a few antifungals that we can use. But we still think that between 200,000 and 400,000 people die of this disease every year. So it is a really big problem. But even with those numbers, that's just the people that we're actually able to diagnose, right? And the question of whether or not there are more people out there who have asymptomatic disease is a big problem. And I think that's a big problem in medical mycology in general, is that we lack figures about how many people are really affected by these diseases.
Do we know what the numbers in the UK are like?
I think it's really difficult to get numbers in the UK because I think it's very rare for us to say someone died of cryptococcus or of aspergillosis or of systemic candidiasis. Typically, we say they died of HIV. What I've been able to sort of get from clinicians is there might be 200 cases in the UK every year of this disease. So it is relatively low in this country. And it's not like we're getting more and more infections every year. It's not something that people need to panic about. And I think that's what I want to emphasize. There was a little bit of a fervor on the news that maybe this was a fungal outbreak. And it really does not present as an outbreak, right? It's about vulnerable people being exposed.
So what do hospitals do to prevent this type of infection?
Unlike many other important infections, cryptococcus is not something that you go into a hospital and you come down with cryptococcosis. And that's because for the most part, hospitals are really well protecting their patients who would be vulnerable for this. So it's about airflow control. A lot of these rooms will have positive pressure so that no external things can get in. And as long as those things are in place, then patients should be protected. For the majority of times, I think hospital infrastructure, at least in this country, is really up to the challenge.
A huge thank you to Liz for taking the time to talk with us. Just before you go, we'd like to give you some information about our annual conference, which is coming up very soon.
Have you booked your place for the Microbiology Society's annual conference yet? This year, conference will take place from April 8th to the 11th at the ICC Belfast. This year's conference is not one to be missed, with a comprehensive programme of over 30 sessions taking place across 4 days. There'll be scientific sessions, workshops and forums covering the breadth of microbiology research, as well as workshops to develop essential skills like teaching, managing a lab and research ethics. Our annual conference attracts over 1,400 microbiologists from around the world, and provides opportunities for scientists at every stage of their career. If you would like to know more about the conference or to book your tickets, visit our website at microbiologysociety.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, it would be great if you could leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced and edited by me, Matthew Bassett, and you can find more about the Microbiology Society on our website, microbiologysociety.org.